Which term? I'm sorry.
Stream entry.
Stream entry. I'm sorry. I was using a technical term in Theravada Buddhism. Talk about enlightenment in terms of four levels of realization. And the first level is called stream entry. And it's like a quantum leap in practice. And what's most important about it is that, say, it's the point at which you can be sure that there's no decline from that. There's no degeneration from that point. It's stable. And the Buddha says that you can be absolutely sure that you will not have to live more than seven lifetimes. It means that nibbana, ultimate enlightenment, is insured. And that there, it's not possible to be, from that point, to be reborn in a lower realm. So the Buddha is saying, unless you reach that point, you are in a very unsafe area, because there's always the potential and possibility, that you could fall into a lower realm if your practice declines. That's not kind of like trying to inspire like fear in you, but it's just sort of letting you know what's but I think stream entry is a very important, interesting thing to talk about, because there have been innumerable lay Buddhists who've realized this level of enlightenment over the past 2,500 years, going up to the present day. And I think it's for a practicing Buddhist, then that's a really reasonable and intelligent goal to set oneself for practice.
That was just one level.
There are four levels, yes. This first level is distinguished by the abandonment of the view, the attachment to the idea that the body and the mind are atta, or self. But simultaneously with that insight, this is insight that tends to happen in meditation practice, is that all one's doubts about the Buddha's teachings disappear forever, because you've realized they're true. And thirdly, attachment to wrong or misguided ideas of what leads to nirvana also fall away. So there's three things that three fetters that are called that disappear. The essential one is the abandonment of this misguided view about what this body and mind is. But simultaneously with that, or accompanying it, are a cessation of doubts about the truth of the Buddha's teaching, and misguided views about what the practice is. Now, at the same time, there is a vision or an experience of nirvana, of ultimate enlightenment. So it's like the Buddha says, it's like someone looking down into a well, and he sees the clear water at the bottom of the well, but he hasn't actually got all the way down there. But he's got to the well, and he gets a vision of the water in the well. And following that, one of the criteria or characteristics of a stream enterer is that the morality will be extremely strong. But if a stream enterer does every now and again act in an unskillful way, he's characterized by his inability to break a precept or his minor precept, but his inability to conceal it. A stream enterer would never try to conceal or rationalize or blame, would always reveal it to a good friend in the holy life or to someone. So the penetration of the stream, this is the deep experiential understanding of the three characteristics. So how does someone get from that level to the highest level? Just keep penetrating those three characteristics. But the further you go, then the more effect it has on one's whole psyche, one's whole being. And the other defilements disappear in their turn. But it's, you know, anatta, again, you can talk about it on such a very high level as that, but down to earth in daily life, it's just notice, like, when you get up in the morning, maybe there's, like, stuff in your eye. You know, where does that come from? You didn't want it to come there. Or if you're watching a movie or something, and your tears run down, where did that come from? You know? Or, you know, your hair gets longer every day. You know, just all these, just really, just normal, mundane things that happen in life all the time. You know, you go out in the sun and you see warm up. You know, your body changes because of the temperature. You go outside and it's raining, or it gets cold, you shiver. I mean, the body's just doing its stuff. You know, because that's the way the body is. It's opening up to that and observing that. You know, the way the body is conditioned, the way the body conditions the mind, the way the mind conditions the body. This is really leading to understanding the anatta. I think it's just great, you know, that when I first found this, it's great. You know, if you're so kind of obsessed about yourself and bits of it, I don't really like, I wish I was like him, and I wasn't like, you know, you've got these kind of things about yourself you don't really like, you know, and then you realize that the reason why it's so painful is because you think that's who you really are. And it's not. It's irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have any questions?
Well, this is so big, but I work partly as a chaplain at major trauma hospitals in this area. So I see people who are very, very badly injured, and the family members of people who are dying and out of this issue. And with patients who are actually conscious of without preaching to them about Buddhism. That's what we do. Do you have a suggestion of helpful practices to bring the people in this
tradition? Well, firstly, I would say we always tend to think about what we should do. And think that what we're doing in those situations is the main thing. It's often, you know, who we are and just our presence. And that's that sense of if you're in a lot of pain and there's a nurse or someone who's there and you really feel they want to relieve your pain, that they're kind and they're like, that's just such a wonderful thing. It's more calming than almost anything else. The one thing that I teach in Thailand for people with terminally ill rather than people suffering from trauma, so I don't know how applicable this is that there are so many different meditation techniques to employ, and often the discursive ones have not really been very well covered, I think, in the West. And there are a number of meditations called anusati, or recollection meditations. I found if you've got someone, an old person, or someone who's maybe not old, but suddenly they've got cancer, they're facing the end of their life, their family who are Buddhists want them to meditate before they pass away, and it's very difficult, and they try to get them to watch their breath or something. They've never done this when they're healthy, let alone when they've got cancer, you know. And so it doesn't work very well. And what I say is, sit down with that person, get a pencil and paper, and ask them, what are the 10 things that they're most proud of in their life, that they've done for other people, that they've done, and then whenever they think of it, they just feel, that was a really good thing I did. Yeah. And and you sit down with them and you get 10 points, and then you sit with them, and to begin with, you can just sit and talk through number one. Do you remember when we did this, and we made that offering to that charity, or we went to the orphanage, or whatever, you know, and it can be just, doesn't need to be anything very special, but something, that person, when they think about it, they just feel really proud and feel really good, that was something good in my life. And if you can sit and talk, if you've got 10 points, and you're just 3 minutes on each point, someone's mind's been in a very wholesome condition for 30 minutes. And you may well, from there, be able to take them on to mindfulness of breathing or something like that, because their mind is settled down and it's in a very conducive state. You may find that of those 10 points, there might be one which you see the person's really radiant and is really interested in, and then you can just focus on that one. And if you do that on a regular basis, at times when they're going through periods with intense pain, you can just remind them of that, it becomes a refuge to them and something that can calm their mind very much more successfully than a meditation object that's generally used. So this is a meditation that I've taught and I found very successful, and one of my students was telling me, I went to visit her and her mother in hospital just a few weeks ago before her mother passed away. And she said, you know, that really works, you know. I said, I just mentioned that good deed, and her heart and her pulse went down from 180 to like 110 in 30 seconds or something like that. I mean, I can't remember the figures now, but it was really quite remarkable, just the effect that it had. You could just immediately a sense of relaxation and of satki. So I think that as a culture, we've really neglected so many important things. One of them is just the study, understanding of physical pain, and understanding, I mean, physical pain is a part of everybody's life at some time, and it's just such a major thing that you would think that any intelligent education system at some time would teach kids what physical pain is and how to deal with it. But I don't know of any education systems that do that, at least in a systematic way. And I think if you teach kids to be able to breathe into pain, to understand pain, or to identify pain, to developing power of mindfulness, to see pain as a sensation that arises and passes away, these kinds of basic satipatthana techniques, you're giving them a wonderful tool to be able to use throughout their life. And, encouraging people to breathe into their pain, look at their pain, say, you see, this pain, it seems like it's big, sort of, you know, oh, pain. If you look at it, is it stable? Is it permanent? Or is it moving about from place to place? Is the intensity of the pain stable? Or does it fluctuate? Does it come in waves? What's the nature of the pain? Is it sort of burning pain, biting pain, stabbing pain? That effort to just look at what is this, and sort of taking an interest in it, and being friends with it, not seeing it as an enemy. And this is the thing, like with hospitals and things, you know, so-and-so lost his fight against cancer, you know, everything has to be a war in this country, you know, like, so, you know, you've got to fight I mean, the body's just doing, you know, what it should do. You know, it gets sick and it dies. It's not wrong. You know? So, I think, without mentioning Buddhism, just talking about that, if you feel afraid, yeah, it's quite common to feel, but you don't feel afraid all the time, do you? It comes and goes. Yeah. And what is this pain? How does it feel? Whereabouts? What's it like? Yeah, let's talk about it. I think these kinds of things are helpful.
Yeah.
Something I didn't go into in the talk is that we do have this idea of two levels of truth, if you like. It's a conventional level and an ultimate level. Okay, so let's say on the ultimate level, there's no self, and there's just five khandhas or four elements or whatever. But if you had to go to somewhere where you had to show ID and you say, no, this isn't meaningless, this is just five khandhas arising and passing away, you'd have real difficulty, drawing money out of a bank or, whatever. So you have to function in the world. So on a conventional level, the body is yours, yeah. Now, on that level, and you have to look after it and be intelligent about giving it the right amount of rest, giving it the right kinds of food, giving it the kind of exercise that it needs. And this is part of Buddhist practice as well. But I don't think it follows from that you necessarily have to say, therefore it's mine, because I take care of it. I mean, it's like if you were to go and stay in somebody's house while they were away, maybe they got a house up on the coast or somewhere, and say, yeah, you can go and stay in my house through the summer. Even though nothing in the house is yours, you probably take care of it more than if it was yours, wouldn't you? Because you wouldn't want to break anything or to leave the house in a mess. You usually borrow this body, you borrow the elements from nature, the earth element, water element, and you borrow these things as a human being, and when you die, you give them back. You cremate them and bury them, and they return to nature. So it's just a kind of something you borrowed for the time being. Just look at it. That's good. Right? Yeah. And with anatta is something that's really something that most people don't desire, but when it does happen, it really is an opportunity for insight. And that's when you're falsely accused of something. Why is that so painful? Why is that so difficult? It comes down to this idea you have of yourself. If you've done something really selflessly for a group, you've given up your time, you've put a lot of work, a lot of effort in, and you've never asked for any kind of recognition or ever expected it, and quite happy to do that, and then somebody says, you're just doing that because you want other people to praise you, or because you expect some kind of long-term reward from it, and it's not true, but why is that so painful? This is something we need to look at. Does it need to be that painful? What is it that you're contributing to it that makes it more painful than it might be? This is an opportunity for the study of anatta in daily life. In meditation practice, for those of you who are in the meditation practice, I think you'll find that as mindfulness increases and you are able to, the sharpness of mind, ability to catch thoughts, feelings, perceptions as they arise very quickly and they pass away, then the tendency is to identify with the knower and create a new self out of the one that knows the arising and passing away of phenomena, and the one who is aware of this and aware of that. So that's a kind of more subtle track to be aware of as your practice progresses. So I've often talking about Buddhism and often compare Buddhism with the religions that grew up in the Middle East, particularly Judaism, Christianity, Islam. Now those religions, we can say, are belief systems. So if you can, if you do believe in the New Testament or in the Bible, then you can be a Christian. If you don't, you can't. And in fact, we use the word faith to refer to these religions. We call them the great faiths. Okay. And for that reason, most people find Buddhism rather difficult to comprehend. Many Buddhists, if they're talking with Christian friends or friends who adhere to a religion which is a belief system, they say, well, you're a Buddhist, what do you believe in? So, and there's the assumption that Buddhism is just a different kind of belief system. But I think it's important to recognize that Buddhism is a different kind of religion to the belief system, group or family of religions. And I would characterize Buddhism as an education system. So there's this idea of religion as belief system and religion as education system. And the word that I referred just now to Sila Samadhi Panya, and we call this the threefold training or threefold education. So the word education and training were synonymous in the time of the Buddha. So our understanding of what education these days means is much more focusing on learning, memorizing. But in Buddhism, you have this idea of theory and practice as being one, indissolubly connected, and can refer to that either as education or training. So the four areas of Buddhist education that have to be followed simultaneously and as one. Firstly, what the Buddha called kaya bhavana or physical education. And that means one's relationship to the physical world, beginning with that aspect of the physical world which we're most intimate with, which is our own physical body. And this refers to, again, to exercise, diet, how we spend our time, how much work, how much rest, how much time we spend with our family, how much time in spiritual practices, and so on. It refers to our relationship to our belongings, our possessions, the things that we conventionally call mine, our relationship to the physical environment. So this whole sphere of our relationship to the physical world is one area of Buddhist practice or education. Second area is our relationship to the social world, our relationship to family, other family members, relationship to the communities we live in, the society we live in, the world we live in. And this is a whole area of Sila Bhavana. And there's a very interesting, I find it very interesting, very short quote from the Buddha. He said, what is a sage? And he says, a sage is someone who does not hurt himself or others. So there's the proof of the pudding is how you live your life. Yeah. And so if you want to know who's a really wise person, you don't need to see what academic qualifications they've got, but the most sure is, do they keep the five precepts? If someone can keep the five precepts purely and intelligently, he's a sage, she's a sage. If they haven't, no matter what their intellectual attainment might be, Buddha doesn't call that person a sage. So if you really understand if you really believe there is such a thing as liberation from suffering, and that the Buddha's path is the path towards that, that you have the potential as a human being to realize realize that through following the path. If you understand the law of karma clearly, then you will be very committed to the five precepts. Another Buddha says, the sage, the wise person, is known by his conduct. So this is the importance of the external. Some people think Buddhism is this kind of passive, introspective, you know, the world's a mess, just close your eyes, meditate, make your mind peaceful, and if everybody did that, then everything would be alright. Except, well, they're not going to, and it's not alright. And it's not what the Buddha taught anyway. Because the Buddha taught the Dhamma and the Vinaya. He called his religion, he didn't call it Buddhism, he called it Dhamma Vinaya. Dhamma is the internal practice and Vinaya is the external practice. And Vinaya means the effort to create and sustain the social conditions most conducive to the practice and realization of Dhamma. And that is the responsibility of lay Buddhists to contribute to that as best they can in their own immediate social community, the family, the village, the town, city, country. If you're living in a neighborhood which is full of crime, and you feel fear every time you walk along the road, or fear until your children are safely home at night, you can't just say, well, just go and sit and meditate and let go, you know, it's just an impermanent feeling. There's something that has to be done. And the idea that Buddhism is this passive turning away from the world is a misrepresentation of what the Buddha taught. External conditions are very important, and efforts should be made to, as I say, to the extent that one can, to create, sustain, support those conditions most conducive to practice and realization of Dhamma. The internal education starts off with the citta pavana, and that's the training in virtue, skillful means to abandon unwholesome dhammas like selfishness and greed and jealousy and hatred and prejudice etc. And development of the wholesome dhammas of kindness and compassion, patience, diligence, and so on, so and to peace of mind, inner peace and calm, clarity. This is the internal education of the citta, and then wisdom development means constantly developing a habit and an ability to reflect on experience. To reflect on experience in terms of the three characteristics of impermanence and dukkha and not self, reflecting on the conditioned nature of things over and over and over again, so that the mind is primed. And when the mind is very, very peaceful in full meditation, then the mind will be ready to develop very deep wisdom. It leads to complete release from defilements. Well, one of the reasons I'm telling you about this is this is a very long-winded introduction to my group who have followed me here from Thailand. Although Thailand is a Buddhist country, many of you may be surprised to know that it's never developed a model of Buddhist education. In fact, until the late 19th century, most education was carried on in the monasteries. And interestingly enough, the standards of literacy in 18th, 19th century Thailand were far higher than they were in the West, 18th century. The decline in body size of Asians and IQ and all these things are exactly coincide with the onset of colonialism. But in the late 19th century, efforts were made to consolidate Thailand as a nation state rather than a series of a number of small semi-independent fiefdoms, I guess you'd call them, with sort of very levels of relationship with a king and a center. Now, I won't go into all this too much, but they say that there was an adoption of a Western economic model, political model, education model. Western-style schools were developed. Subsequently, a number of Catholic schools were opened as part of Catholic missionary activities, and Catholic schools provided very good education, and the majority of the elite, Buddhist elite in Thailand, attended Catholic schools and then did their degrees in America or England or elsewhere. So the understanding of Buddhism amongst the educated, so more elite in Thailand, has been extremely weak for a very long time. In public schools, Buddhism was taught and then taught less and less, and then came back a bit, and now kind of economic imperatives train people to fit into the economic regime that's taken precedence. But the good news is that in the ongoing process of education reform in Thailand, it was decided almost out of the blue a couple of years ago to give schools the chance to declare themselves or become Buddhist schools. And it was not expected that this would attract much support. Schools were being asked to specialize in one particular way. And this was added to the list because Catholic schools were there, and so it was a bit strange if you have to be a Catholic school where there's no Buddhist school. So there's a Buddhist school. Now, 30,000 public schools in Thailand, now 12,000 have said that they want to be Buddhist schools, which has caught the Ministry of Education completely by surprise. And to this day, there are only, I think, five civil servants in the Ministry of Education who are responsible for the 12,000 Buddhist schools. Now, the whole concept of Buddhist education and what it might mean in the public sector is a matter of some debate, and it's not really very clear. But there is an example being given by a number of private schools which have been set up as specifically Buddhist schools for a number of years now. And of the three main schools involved in this movement, spearheading this Buddhist education movement, there are staff from two of these schools sitting at the back of the hall today, including the two headmistresses. And I'm an advisor to these schools and interested in using this these four spheres of education that I just explained to you as a basis for the education given in these schools, and to adapt the curriculum, which to a certain extent is, or to a large extent is, determined by the ministry, to fit in with this framework. So the schools require that all the teachers keep five precepts and do meditation retreats every year. We have the kids start in the morning with taking the five precepts, and they chant, and they do some walking meditation and sitting meditation, and generally study like other school children. But the very important, a lot of importance is given to creating a real harmony of approach between the children and teachers and the parents. So there's more and more parents now wanting to join in meditation retreats because they're finding their kids know more about Buddhism than they do. So part of my, part of our aim on this trip to America, primary aim was to offer the katina cloth at a ceremony at a Bayagiri Buddhist monastery, which some of you may know about, which is situated in Northern California. and also to visit other people involved in Buddhist education, particularly City of 10,000 Buddhas, and also when we come back to Seattle in a couple of days, we'll be visiting some alternative schools in this area to compare with what we're doing in Thailand, if there's a comparison, and to learn some more practical ways of applying the principles that we've decided upon. Just give you some idea of what I'm doing here, if anybody is interested, apart from meeting with all of you.
Ajahn, is this something that you're committing to on an ongoing basis now, that we can expect to see coming to the States in this capacity?
It's not sure.
Thank you, Ajahn. Thank you, Jomi, and thank you, Ajahn, for this wonderful presentation this evening. If there are no further questions, I think we'll call it an evening. The young one who is here to speak again Wednesday night at Watatama, 7 o'clock. Thank you all for coming.